This podcast, normally explicit, is not so today. It's Thursday, July 28th, 2022, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and the Mega Millions jackpot is up to $1.02 billion. By law, we have to assume you cannot hear words that start with a B. Therefore, we have to say that's billion with a B. You know how big $1.02 billion is? Well, every single news station in America wants to put it in perspective. I literally saw a guy saying, if every dollar was a dash on the highway road, you could go from Cleveland to LA and back 498 times, and then you'd get to $1 billion. Oh, thanks for clarifying it. But every dash isn't a dollar. And who wants to go from Cleveland to LA? All right, it was a Cleveland station, but still. And 498 times. Did you really clarify it or just add a bunch of extra abstractions for us to get confused about? But I will give you a little bit of an idea about how big the $1.02 billion of it is. That 0.02, that was the last time someone won the Mega Millions. It was for $20 million. That's literally 0.02. And it's not like no one played the Mega Millions then. I'd say 20 is still a mega amount of millions. That's millions with an M. Millions of people played trying to win that $20 million, which is now a rounding error for the big drawing that will happen tomorrow. The other big thing that's going on is many, many news articles about how unhappy lottery winners are. Washington Post, as Mega Millions hits 1 billion, winning doesn't mean a happy ending. No, nothing means anything. But the idea that winning the lottery correlates to sadness is both an outdated and disproved and thoroughly ubiquitous idea. I give you Time Magazine, January 12th, 2016, Powerball, how winning the lottery makes you miserable. And then, 2 years later, 2018, everything you know about the fate of lottery winners is wrong. Well, what's everything I know? Some of what I know was based on your magazine 2 years prior, and it was the incorrect idea that winning the lottery makes you miserable. It's quite an interesting statement about human psychology that we need this idea. The idea is often cited to a statistic credited to the National Endowment for Financial Education that says, according to the National Endowment for Financial Education, 70% of lottery winners eventually go bankrupt. And if you research that idea, you get a bunch of hits citing it, but you get one hit, and thankfully it's a prominent hit, from the organization itself saying, we have no idea why anyone would cite us in relation to that statistic. We've never done a study where this statistic was even tested, let alone proved. The good statistics or good studies include in 2006, a study of the Journal of Health Economics of lottery winners in Britain found that winners, quote, go on to exhibit significantly better psychological health. And a study of U.S. lottery winners from the 80s found that winning a lot of money increased reported savings rates. No kidding. Now, there is one story, one famous or infamous story, I think, that has a large hold on our imagination. A guy named Jack Whitaker, maybe you've heard about him or seen him. If I show you a picture, he wears a black cowboy hat. He won a huge lottery in West Virginia in the early 2000s. And a reporter named April Witt did a really compelling story about the guy because he had so much happen to him after he won these over $100 million prize. But the thing about Jack Whitaker, well, here's April Witt from a C-SPAN interview.
He went into a strip club in Cross Lanes, West Virginia, the Pink Pony, and put $50,000 down on the bar. Well, people were not used to seeing that kind of money down on the counter, and the managers were worried that that cash would attract trouble.
So if you're the kind of guy who's going to pull that stuff, you had a little bit of that in you, maybe a lot of it in you before. And what happened to Whitaker?
According to some women who've since sued him, he sexually harassed some attendants at the racetrack. He just got too big for his britches, they would say, in West Virginia, and sort of was rough with these female attendants.
Things went even worse from there. His life unraveled. His granddaughter died of a drug overdose. So many people who were somehow associated with him and his largesse came to regret ever having known him. I wish we could have ripped up that lottery ticket, said his, by then, ex-wife, Jewel. But it's a little like Kim Kardashian and the sex tape. The huge exception holds a prime place in our imagination. Everyone's like, I'm going to do a sex tape. It'll launch me to a famous career. It worked for Kim Kardashian. Yeah, and no one else. So I'm not saying no one else, no other. If you search, you will find stories of someone who won $10 million and then declared bankruptcy in Canada, and someone who won $15 million and didn't do well in the UK. But there are thousands of lottery winners, and the stories we tell would tend to gravitate to the ones that have elements of drama, which is conflict, which is usually a rise and fall and perhaps rise again. A quick injection, a deus ex machina of 10 or a billion dollars from the gods and then living quietly and never bothering anyone in the national media, that is not a story that is told. So it is not true that if you win this $1 billion, you will likely declare bankruptcy or be unhappy. It is also not true that you will win this $1 billion. But if you do, as I understand how these things work, good luck walking from Cleveland to Los Angeles. On the show today, I spiel about a Senate hearing about policing that shows our partisan divide and just how hard it is for any involved citizen to really understand the priorities and problems of our country. But first, July 20, 2012, a man enters a Colorado movie theater and shoots and kills 12 people during a showing of a Batman film. Dozens more are injured, some seriously. We talked to this man's psychiatrist, Dr. Lynn Fenton, about her new book, Aurora, the psychiatrist who treated the movie theater killer, tells her story. The killer, as we name him often, I should forewarn, was James Holmes. The psychiatrist, Dr. Lynn Fenton, details her sessions with a soon-to-be mass shooter, and that's up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. On July 20th, 2012, which I realize is the day, 10 years ago to the day that I am recording this interview, although you will be hearing it at a later date, but 10 years ago to this day, a man named James Holmes entered an Aurora, Colorado screening of a Batman movie and shot and killed 12 people and injured 70. You no doubt remember that story. Joining me now is the psychiatrist who treated Holmes beforehand, was at the trial, herself faced, well, not just backlash, but a legal suit because of her treatment. And she now reflects on all of that time. The name of her book is Aurora, The psychiatrist who treated the movie theater killer tells her story. It's co-written by Dr. Lynn Fenton and Kerry Drobin. Dr. Fenton, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me about a little bit about your background and practice before Holmes even became a patient?
Yes. Well, I'm a psychiatrist, and I was working at the University of Colorado in Aurora. And at that medical campus, we had a student mental health service. So all the graduate students from all the multiple programs, so like the medical school, dental school, nursing, and the PhD programs, of which Holmes was in one, all of the students could come using their student insurance to get any type of mental health help, medications, counseling, support from our service.
Were you set up to handle serious cases of mental illness?
Yes. We would occasionally see somebody, for instance, with schizophrenia or very, very, very severe depression, PTSD, things like that.
What were the circumstances that Holmes came to you as a patient?
So it's interesting because, you know, most of these mass shooters don't come in for mental health treatment, but he did. But he actually came for something completely unrelated to wanting to kill people. It was for anxiety. So he's a very awkward and nervous kind of guy, and his lab presentations in the PhD program apparently were so bad that one of his advisors said, you know, hey, we have this student mental health service. Why don't you go in there and see if they can help you with your anxiety? So that's why he came in.
Now, when you said he didn't come in wanting or talking about wanting to kill people, did he ever do that generally or specifically with you?
He never wanted treatment for that. And the only reason we knew that he had these thoughts is he just said, you know, kind of off the cuff, I have thoughts of killing people. Very vague. And so, you know, I spent the next several months that I was working with him over six sessions trying to understand what that meant. You know, are these just sort of obsessive thoughts popping into his head? He doesn't like them. Or is he actually thinking about doing something? And if so, what are his targets? You know, does he have a date? Does he have a plan how to do this? And, you know, I was never able to get any kind of specifics out of him.
Had you dealt with that sort of thing before, a patient saying that? And if it did get specific, what are the legal requirements for you around that?
It's not uncommon to have people have sort of angry or gruesome or violent thoughts pop into their head. Say, you're super mad at somebody and you're like, I just would like to strangle the person, you know, and you sort of in your head and envision that. Or some people who have different types of obsessive disorders or very severe, say, postpartum depression can also have these just unwanted violent thoughts come in. They're like, what's wrong with me? Why am I thinking about flushing my baby down the toilet? You know, things like that.
Right. But they would say, what's wrong with me? They would talk to them as if it bothered them that they had those thoughts, but Holmes didn't.
Yes. The day that I realized it didn't bother him, I just, you know, my stomach just sank. And because I asked him about that, and he's like, oh, I don't mind thinking about them. Well, how often do you think about them? Five or six times a day. It's like, this is a different animal.
Yeah.
A lot of the public or people not familiar with a so-called mental health hold are like, well, why didn't you just lock him up? You know, as soon as he expressed these ideas. But because these types of thoughts would be so common and only a tiny fraction of folks who would think these things would ever actually do something about it, there's pretty strict rules. For instance, it can't just be a vague statement, I think about killing people. It's got to be the person needs to have a target, so maybe a person or a group or a place, and it has to be something relatively imminent. So it can't just be, why someday I'm going to get back at these people. You know,
right.
It's got to be, I hate my mother-in-law, and, you know, within the next week or as soon as I buy a gun, I'm going to make her sorry. You know, something pretty specific like that.
If he even said, I want to go to the Century 16 movie theater during, that would count.
And oh, absolutely.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. The day before the murder, he mailed you a book, a notebook, part treatise, part manifesto, I'm sure, part just hard to decipher what he was saying. But that would absolutely, had you had that in time, been an action item.
Totally. As it was, I didn't have any of that stuff, and very unfortunately. And so I did a lot of things, but, you know, we didn't have the ability to just lock them up somewhere.
Right. So just tell me in general, as much as you can, and maybe you can even tell me how much you can. It seemed like you were, you were asked to testify under oath. I read your book. I don't know to what extent patient-client privilege still exists, but tell me how he presented, what his affect was, and what kind of things you talked about and how he talked about them during your sessions.
The judge at the end of the trial made all of the evidence, and so that includes my time with Holmes, all the forensic evals, et cetera. He made it all public record. So Holmes was just, you know, kind of odd from the get-go. He originally talked to my colleague on the student mental health service, our social worker, Margaret Roth, and she called me right up after she saw him. She's like, this is the most nervous guy I have ever seen. Mm-hmm. And he says he has thoughts of killing people. I don't think he's dangerous, but I think it would be a good idea if you personally saw this guy, and we just kind of kept him close. So, you know, I contacted him right away. We set up an appointment for a few days later. And he was pretty, first of all, he's a very smart guy. He's in, you know, this prestigious neuroscience program. But he was beyond just kind of nerdy. I came into the waiting room. He was sort of lounging, like leaning way back in the chair, like in a weird, awkward way, and then sort of sprang standing up. So even his movements were like a little kind of jerky or robotic.
And with your military background, we should tell listeners, you were trained to notice these things and to look at the person's gait, and all this is important for your evaluation.
Right. And that's actually because so psychiatry is my second medical specialty. My one before that is physical medicine and rehabilitation. And that's what I was doing when I was in the Air Force. Yes. And so we were kind of experts in disability and movement and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, wow, you know, this is unusual. But the most striking thing in talking to him was how little he would say. His answers were very abrupt. It kind of reminded me of like a teenager who doesn't want to talk to an adult. How are you doing? How was your day at school? Fine. You know, it was kind of like that. And so I really had to try to use any of my skills to make him more comfortable, get him to talk. And I was just, you know, trying every which way. And it was rare that I would get him to say more than a sentence.
But he was there on his own volition. It seems like he was there against his will, but you tell me.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, because his advisor had said, you know, hey, why don't you go in to help with your anxiety? So he came in. He realized, I think, that he was very nervous and very awkward when he had to like stand up in front of the group and give like a slideshow. And so he willingly was coming in for that aspect.
How many sessions did you do with him over what period of time?
I saw him six times from about over a couple to 3 months. The last time I saw him was early June, 5-6 weeks before the shooting.
For how serious his condition seemed to be, is that enough therapy, do you think?
In some ways, I don't even know if I can call it therapy because he said so little. It was more like me trying to understand what the heck was going on with him. I would float some, you know, sort of therapeutic ideas, but he, you know, usually wouldn't respond at all or have sort of a non sequitur response. But that brings us to the point of, say you get somebody who wants to kill people, and for some reason you actually get them into treatment. They're admitting that they want to do this. Is there, what can you do? So now if it's part of, say, like a psychosis, like say the person's paranoid schizophrenic and they're so frightened, they think maybe they need to kill other people because they're after them. Well, you know, we can treat that with antipsychotics. But most of these shooters, it's not really a mental illness per se that's driving them to do the shooting. It's more sort of a hatred, maybe a wish to be notorious or seen as powerful, or themselves to be powerful. And I mean, we don't have any treatment for those types of things, or for antisocial personality disorder. There's not therapy or medications to treat those things. So, you know, I would say that was not an adequate amount of time to treat anybody who actually is, you know, hell-bent on shooting up a place.
You prescribed Zoloft, or a generic for Zoloft, but did you ever make a diagnosis?
That was a tricky one. He had an anxiety disorder, most likely like social anxiety or generalized anxiety.
Yeah.
That's what the meds were for.
But that seems like an easy one. Like day one of therapy, you're like,
yeah,
anxiety is exactly. A big umbrella,
totally.
And
he's
we'll
got
give
that.
You. Right.
But, you know, what the heck was this other weirdness, you know, and just his... And what was like driving, or what was behind this thoughts of killing people? And the closest that I got to a diagnosis was I thought perhaps he had one of the personality disorders that we call schizoid personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's these sort of like strange, aloof people who have very few human interactions and don't really care for it. He didn't quite fit that, but that I thought that was the closest. What I was really worried about was that perhaps he was devolving into like an actual psychotic state. A lot of the things he said were weird enough that I was like, that is kind of getting far away from reality. You know, is this a psychotic person? On the one hand, he's very functional. He's, you know, taking care of himself. You know, he has some friends. He's in this PhD program. On the other hand, just his statements were so bizarre. So I was, you know, trying hard to see if maybe this was becoming a new psychotic illness, which I potentially could hospitalize him for and get him on medications.
There are a couple court-appointed psychiatrists. One was William Reed. One was Jeffrey Metzner. They actually, after he was arrested, met with him more in depth and longer than you did. And I'll also add to that, maybe he had less to hide with them. But Metzner diagnosed him as having schizoaffective disorder, and Reed found schizotypal personality. I'm not exactly sure what these mean. Mm-hmm. To me, the layman, it means something like schiz-ish, you know, not quite schizophrenia.
Yes.
But do you think, do you think you missed those diagnoses?
I looked closely for those, and at the time I saw him, he did not have those. Now, of course, when schizophrenia or schizotypal disorder develop, then you can have kind of a prodrome where they're a little off and they're sort of heading that direction. But to me, I mean, I never saw him after our therapy finished. But what I saw of him, I still don't think he has a full-blown psychotic disorder. But regardless of exactly what we say his diagnosis is, what it came down to for the trial and why he did this was that he knew what he was doing. So, like, he lied to me during the last month of our treatment. He actually was amassing an arsenal and going to the shooting range, but saying, oh, no, you know, I'm not going to do this. I don't have any weapons. So every bit of evidence they collected for the trial indicated that he knew right from wrong. He realized this was a bad thing. So unlike very rare, like really psychotic person who actually doesn't understand this is a good thing. Like, say, maybe a mom with terrible postpartum psychosis who kills her child because she thinks she's helping them. You know, the devil is in them or something. But Holmes knew what he was doing. He took like months of planning, and it was clear that even if he had some kind of psychotic-ish disorder, that did not prevent him from knowing right from wrong.
Do you think James Holmes was treatable?
Boy, I and the consultant were trying to convince him to take an antipsychotic because by the last few treatments, I thought, even if it's just like a personality disorder, he's got this kind of a psychotic level thinking. And sometimes a low dose of an antipsychotic can help with that. So I think maybe if he had taken one of those, that might have straightened out his thinking a little bit. But such a large portion of it just seemed to be the more this sort of antisocial kind of hatred or like no good reason. I'm just going to kill people, which it just made no sense. And that part, I don't know how to read.
Lynn Fenton is a psychiatrist at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. She is the co-author, along with Kerry Drobin, of the new book, Aurora, the psychiatrist who treated the movie theater killer tells her story. Thank you so much, Dr. Fenton.
Thank you for having me.
And now the spiel. Tuesday was a day for hearings into weapons and policing on Capitol Hill. The House Oversight Committee is investigating semi-automatic rifles. They dubbed them assault rifles. And several manufacturers were before them for a sparring match in a rare occurrence. The liberal Democrats came better armed for this fight. But Wednesday, after the hearings, Wednesday was to be a day for legislating, and that didn't happen, and it's not going to happen. Neither the assault weapons ban nor a policing bill was introduced. The assault weapons ban, again, their phrase, may never happen given seven rural Democrats aren't on board. As to policing, it's possible to pass a bill. The problem is the tension between progressives and the Congressional Black Caucus on one hand and moderates and centrists on the other hand. What should we have more of, police accountability or police funding? The centrists say accountability is fine, we want the funding. The progressives say funding's not so great, we need the accountability. To quote Politico, moderate Democrats have pushed for months for floor votes to show their commitment to supporting local police. After a scourge of GOP attack ads last cycle portrayed their party as anti-cop and soft on crime, those attacks, according to the Democrats' own campaign arm, were, quote, alarmingly potent in key swing districts, and many battleground members believe it cost the party seats in the last election. The House is at a standstill. Over in the Senate, a hearing on policing offered a lot of insight as to party priorities and constraints. Though Democrat Dick Durbin chairs the Justice Committee, the meeting was called at the request of Republican Chuck Grassley, which Durbin allowed in the spirit of bipartisanship, but also to show that, yes, Democrats care about policing as well. Durbin may have regretted giving Republicans the floor, especially at the point when Tom Tillis of North Carolina pointed to a Democratic fundraising site hosting one fundraiser in the low thousands of dollars, which was to raise money for a 13.12-mile run. Why 13.12 miles? Don't ask me. Ask Tom Tillis.
Why 3.12 miles? Because 3.12 translates into the alphabet for ACAB, which equals all cops are bastards. This is on the Act Blue website that they raised $250,000 on. The same website raised $513 million between April the 1st and June 30th of this year. This radical concept of defunding the police has gone from the radical left, a minority of the party, to something that the primary fundraising engine for liberal progressives is now touting.
Durbin disassociated himself with that sentiment, and all the fundraising done on that site in the name of progressive causes can't be traced back to Democratic senators, Durbin pointed out. Later, Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, had this to say in defense of his party.
Last thing in the world we want to do is delegitimize our police or defund them. In fact, I've advocated that we give them more resources.
Blumenthal's sentiment was echoed by Senators Klobuchar and Whitehouse, Democrats all, with law enforcement backgrounds. They were either all state AGs or district attorneys or U.S. attorneys, and they all talked about the programs they funded and the bills they co-sponsored with Republicans. I found out Whitehouse co-sponsored one with Josh Hawley. And these bills generally help police recruitment or increase police resources. Here's Klobuchar.
I wanted to just clarify a few things. I just heard about defund the police. I'll give you an example of my city of Minneapolis. There was a ballot initiative that was described that way. I opposed it, so did the governor, and it actually was defeated in a liberal city. I think one of the focuses has got to be, as you all know, reforming some of the practices, but at the same time, funding the police.
Nothing inaccurate there, a position I endorse. But when it came to Republicans, they weren't just convincing listeners of the double negative of being against defunding. They were taking up the issue full-throatedly in a way that someone concerned with crime might identify with. Now, Senators Cruz and Blackburn, they demagogued a bit. But Chuck Grassley cited the FBI statistic of 73 police officers intentionally killed last year, meaning felonious killings, not accidents or COVID deaths. That is the most since 2001. Then Mike Lee of Utah talked about just a couple incidents in his state.
Utah, more police officers were shot at in 2021 than in any other recorded year, resulting in injury to 8 police officers. In one of those cases, 2 officers were injured when they went simply to check on a man who was lying in the grass near the sheriff's office in Salt Lake City. And as they were doing that, the man opened fire on them. And just last week, a 4-year-old boy shot at police officers from inside a vehicle in Salt Lake City, claiming that he had been encouraged to do precisely that by his father.
That couldn't have happened, and yet it did.
A 27-year-old Salt Lake City man is in jail tonight after police say he told his 4-year-old to fire a weapon at officers.
Officers with the Unified Police Department say this is unlike anything they've seen their entire careers.
Fox 13 Utah with that clip. Anecdotes aren't data, but in this case, anecdotes bear out the data. Policing is difficult, increasingly deadly. If you're an unarmed black man, should you be more frightened of being killed by police than a police officer should be afraid of being killed in the line of duty? The answer is the police officer, statistically speaking, should be much more afraid. It's not close. By the way, it should be the police officer is more afraid. He swore an oath. He put himself or she put herself in the line of danger. And as tragic as any killing is, police do sign up for it. An unarmed individual not actively engaged in assaulting the police should not fear for his life. But I do think in national media coverage and within the kinds of communities where police are unpopular, the perception is bad. Backwards, the perception of danger. In most of America, however, the sentiment is that police are under assault. That is a prevalent sentiment. And police themselves certainly believe it's true. And as we pointed out, there is data to back up those beliefs. You can see through the statements of the Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee that they understand these beliefs. And through the legislation they've sponsored, they acknowledge that anti-police violence is, in fact, a problem. If you're asking yourself, but is it really more of a problem than police perpetrating violence? You're stuck in a zero-sum mindset. It is not the case that violence visited upon police is always blowback or somehow inevitable or cosmic justice. It does not. This issue, these two issues, violence against the police, violence perpetrated by the police, those do not have to be two sides of a debate.
Well-trained, well-supported police, more secure in their safety, will actually engage in violence less. Populations policed by supported law enforcement will be safer. It is not easy to turn the current trend lines around, but it is possible. We've done it before. To do it again, we should recognize that we all need to guard our guardians so that they can best guard us. That's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the assistant producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson is the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the COO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompru, jeepru, doopru, and thanks for listening.